Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on the show, a collaboration with the Casper Star Tribune on Natrona County's approach to child sexual abuse.
We're taking sexual assault cases to trial, and we're winning them. That's super, super unheard of.
The state legislature is looking at solutions to the race to operatorship problem. Oil and gas developers are flooding the state with permit requests.
And it's not, I guess, a productive system and a cooperative system.
There's growing bipartisanship behind the idea of charging a fee for producing carbon.
This can cut greenhouse gas emissions by 50% in 20 years.
And we will find out what is so difficult to get new information about an officer-related shooting in Laramie. Join us for Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's hard to accept, but child sexual abuse can happen in any community. Prosecuting these crimes means that kids have to disclose the details of what happened. As Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports, there are things that law enforcement, prosecutors, and social services can do to help kids navigate that process.
Kaylin Cook was born and raised in Green River, Wyoming. Spectacular rock formations dominate the scenery in this small town, but Cook's childhood there was anything but serene. She was just 2 years old when a medical condition raised a red flag. She says it was her aunt who clued into what was going on. An exam revealed signs of sexual abuse, but didn't provide conclusive evidence about who was doing it.
I wasn't really able to get on the stand and say he actually did this to me. I mean, a two-year-old just can't do that.
At age two, kids are just starting to put words together into simple sentences. Cook didn't yet have the verbal skills to convince anyone that her own stepfather was the perpetrator, and the case went nowhere.
And then it didn't come out again until I was nine, when I told my best friend that stuff was going on.
Through that friend, word got to the Department of Family Services.
DFS came and picked me up from school, and it was terrifying.
Cook had a brief phone conversation with her mom before being pulled out of school. She says her mom told her the allegations would tear her family apart. Cook was scared, so when DFS sat her down for an interview, she recanted. But the abuse continued, and at age 14, she disclosed it to her boyfriend. He told the police, and this time she was brought to the station to do an interview.
There was no evidence. It really was just my word against his. I don't think the detective really did a good job with interviewing, and the case was dropped. There was insufficient evidence.
In her eyes, all of the mechanisms in place to protect kids had failed.
I was kind of dropped by the system. And then when I was 16, a conversation was taking place between me and my perpetrator, and I hit record on my phone.
And she got a recorded confession from her stepdad, which eventually led to his conviction. But he was only sentenced to 10 years probation. Watching her abuse drag out for 15 years fueled a passion to see these cases handled differently. So Cook pursued a career in law enforcement and now works as a victim advocate in Cheyenne. She says things are changing in Wyoming.
We're taking sexual assault cases to trial, and we're winning them. That's super, super unheard of.
She points to a recent trial in Natrona County where a six-year-old girl's testimony helped convict her abuser. The investigator on the case was Taylor Courtney.
These investigations are by far the most complex investigations. They're largely circumstantial and a lot of times lack a lot of physical evidence. And not only are they difficult to work, but they, at the end of the day, they take an emotional toll.
And that's why Courtney works these cases with a multidisciplinary team, or MDT. Social services, law enforcement, and the prosecuting attorney work together to build a case and to help kids heal and recover.
Having the team is extremely effective at solving these cases and actually having the cases brought forth before the court.
He says a critical piece of this process is the Children's Advocacy Project. CAP, as it's called for short, is located just a few blocks from the courts and the sheriff's department in a simple one-story house.
Hi.
Hey, I'm Tennessee.
Hi, I'm Bailey. It's nice,
nice to meet you.
Bailey Height is a forensic interviewer who specializes in working with children. She uses open-ended questions to draw out the details of what happened. The technique also helps identify false allegations, which she says are rare. She shows me the rooms where she meets with kids.
You don't want them to be too stimulating, so there's distractions. So we try to keep it as warm, but as plain as possible.
The room where she meets with older kids has two big comfy chairs and an area rug. Kids under six meet in a room with a tiny table and two tiny chairs.
We get on their level when we do talking with them and then just offer crayons, coloring, so it's more comfortable for them.
She says the more comfortable kids are, the more likely they are to open up, and that's key. Sexual abuse usually happens in secret, so there aren't witnesses. That means a kid's testimony is the primary piece of evidence. And the more details a kid can provide about the circumstances of the abuse, the easier it is for law enforcement to verify their allegations. Each room has a camera, so members of the MDT can watch and hear the interview without overwhelming the kid.
So it's not scary for them because they're really only talking to me face-to-face and not a big group of people, but everyone gets the information all in one place, so the child doesn't have to be questioned more than once.
The Child Advocacy Project also has therapists who offer support to kids as they navigate the criminal justice system and in the years that follow the conclusion of their case. Kaylin Cook, the child sexual abuse survivor turned victim advocate, wants all kids in Wyoming to have access to these services.
I know that going through the criminal justice system is extremely complicated, but at least when they come out in the end, they can say, like, I had a friend through this.
There are two other child advocacy centers in Wyoming, one in Cheyenne and one in Jackson, and they work with counties across the state. But it means kids or center staff have to travel, sometimes hours. Because of this, the three centers are working together on a gap survey to identify which parts of the state are in the greatest need of services, in the hopes of someday expanding. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
This story was produced in partnership with the Casper Star Tribune. A link to Shane Sanderson's in-depth reporting on child sexual abuse prosecution is on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney turned some heads in Washington last week when she opposed a resolution denouncing all forms of hate. She was one of a mere 23 who voted against the measure. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Initially, Democratic leaders planned to rebuke freshman Democratic Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar for what were characterized as anti-Semitic remarks after she accused some lawmakers of having dual allegiance to both America and Israel. But then many freshman Democrats and her two Muslim colleagues protested and said it unfairly singled her out. So the resolution was broadened and never named the congresswoman. Cheney says her objection to the resolution was the very fact that Omar was not held accountable.
Could have gone either way on it. The resolution itself didn't have anything objectionable in it, and I said that in my statement. But it also was, in my view, very clearly an effort to protect her by not naming her. The whole resolution was constructed in a way that would essentially enable her.
In fact, Cheney had called for Omar to be stripped of her seat on the Foreign Affairs Committee over the remarks even before the vote. Cheney's critical of Democrats for what she says is the party leaders essentially letting Omar off the hook.
I think you saw that when she went out afterwards and said that, it was a huge victory for her. I think it's really important that we all stand up against anti-Semitism, and I think you've seen the Republicans doing that.
But Jewish Democrats remain disappointed in Cheney's vote, especially because she's now the number three ranked House Republican in their leadership team. Here's New York Democratic Congresswoman Nita Lowey, who had initially pushed for the resolution denouncing Omar's allegedly anti-Semitic remarks. So she says it hurts that Cheney opposed an even broader resolution denouncing even more hate speech than the first draft.
It's unfortunate, and she should know better.
GOP leaders did kick Iowa Republican Congressman Steve King off his committees over accusations that he endorsed white supremacy and has embraced neo-Nazi principles. But Illinois Democratic Congressman Jan Schakowsky says GOP leaders never reprimanded any individuals for using racist, misogynistic, or xenophobic language, including Trump himself.
Well, they have not done any resolution whatsoever calling out anybody for by name, including Steve King or anyone, or the President of the United States, who I call him the hate monger in chief.
After the vote, Politico reported that the other GOP leaders were upset with Cheney for opposing the legislation that the rest of the top brass of their leadership team supported. But Cheney says those reports are wrong.
Our leadership team is absolutely unified very much focused on the radical agenda that we've seen from the Democrats.
House Minority Whip Steve Scalise also says the reports are false. He says he agreed with Cheney's position, even if they voted differently.
Look, a lot of members were justified in being disappointed that the resolution didn't go far enough. I think the resolution didn't go far enough.
Cheney is seen as a rising star in the GOP, and that means you can expect to be hearing a lot more from her on national news outlets. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, a discussion about Wyoming's newly approved open records law. And we'll hear what students say about proposals for new dorms at UW. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's Sunshine Week, where media outfits are discussing public access. Wyoming has never been a leader in this area, but a new law could help change things. Lawmakers passed an open records law that requires entities to meet records requests in 30 days. A state-funded ombudsman will make sure requests are met. Cheyenne attorney Bruce Motes, who handles open meetings and records cases, joins us to discuss the new law. He says it was a long time in coming.
Really had support from across the spectrum. And that's something that I thought would be there much earlier than that. I saw that some of the conservative organizations get behind this, which I always thought they should be, given their belief in limited government. And I think that one of the best ways to accomplish that is through transparency. And there's been studies that just recently that have shown that. Frankly, where the local newspaper has gone out of a community, spending has gone up. So I was glad to see that. I think that was one thing that was very encouraging about this particular effort.
So what is missing?
What discouraged me was the move from 7 days to 30 days. The experience across the country about when you set a deadline, what often happens then in controversial or so-called sensitive subjects, that the release then is postponed until that deadline. And so I'm concerned about that will we see governmental entities waiting that 30 days? Particularly journalists around the state have got to watch that and report on it if that in fact is taking place.
The other thing that did change when the Senate got the bill and it went over to the House and there was a little discussion on this is the penalty phase. Should it be a civil penalty? Should it be a criminal penalty, which would mean probably more of a fine, that kind of thing? I was kind of curious your thoughts with ending up as a civil penalty.
It's always been a matter of discussion, and you always hear from local elected officials that, wait a minute, we're volunteers out here working away. We shouldn't be branded as criminals if we make a mistake on open records, open meetings. But what's interesting here is now apparently under both the Open Meetings Act and now with the changes to the Public Records Act that a citizen can actually pursue the civil penalty. I have not been in favor of a penalty provision as much as I have been for an attorney fees provision. And that's because many, you know, citizens who are maybe seeking records and denied records are, you know, it's just too expensive for them to contest it. And so I've always preferred an attorney fees provision. And Michael Krampner, who kind of worked these cases before me, was the same way, because on the other side, you know, public funds are being used to defend these actions. So if somebody is successful, we should be able to reward them by not having them, by having their attorney fees paid.
When you look at this bill, we've all seen different towns and different entities in a town operate differently. Do you think everybody's going to pay attention? Is this going to fix the problems we've seen?
Yeah, I think the fact that the legislature took this up and there was a big push behind is going to signal, hopefully, to many, you know, local governments and other entities that the importance of public access to information. Really, we're not necessarily talking about just open records and open meetings. What we're really talking about is the ability to self-govern. And one just quick point on that, this is, I think, a lot of times gets put in the framework of just being a watchdog, that this information is necessary to catch misconduct. Well, that is part of it, but mainly it's more about understanding the issues that are before government and before us all, and to understand them so we make the best decisions.
They've added an ombudsman in. It's a state position. This is somebody who's supposed to help all the local agencies meet these requests. Good idea, do you think?
Yeah, I think it certainly could be, and part of it would be for those citizens who, you know, can't, as I was talking about before, can't afford to maybe litigate it. Now they can go to the ombudsman, and if they get a decision there, and then that's publicized, I think that's going to, you know, that could be could provide a way, and a way, hopefully, if the office works quickly. I think that's an important thing. I think it can't be something that just lengthens out the process. If that happens, then really we're not making much progress forward, because, as I said before, usually the request for, you know, records or even to attend meetings comes when there's some issue that's important to people before a governing body. So I think that's real key. It has the potential to be very good.
Bruce Motes, always nice chatting with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
A new law passed by the legislature gives UW the ability and funding for new student housing construction. This bill came about after years of discussion about what to do about student housing. Nolan Benke reports.
The law required that new dorms be built next to 15th Street, one of the busiest streets in town. The university has not built new student housing since the Vietnam War, and the current housing has been overbooked for the past two semesters. The bill was pushed through this past legislative session with little resistance. Criticism on the bill was mostly over the big price tag. The money would come mostly from the legislature over the next 30 years, but the university would have to pay it all back by raising tuition costs. Students, however, say that the new housing would be beneficial to both them and the university.
I think it's pretty cool. I haven't really read into that, but I think new dorms would be really good. Because I don't know exactly how old ours are, but I know that some are pretty bad. Well, I think it'd make it more modern and probably attract more students. Just attract more students, and it might help kind of put Wyoming more on the map.
Well, I think it's a good move for sure. I think that it's time for the dorms to be updated, and, you know, I hope that the money is used wisely and spent well.
The first speaker is Becca from Whitehall, and the second speaker is Hunter from McIntyre Hall. New dorms would take up space from the Wyoming Union parking lot to the YO Hall, and would be up to 6 stories high. Dorms would have to house 300 to 600 students. Since much of the construction would be near 15th Street, it would create traffic problems for both pedestrians and cars.
I feel like it's probably not the best place for dorms. It's kind of out of the way compared to the rest of them, but that's probably going to cause a lot of traffic and all that, so not looking forward to it.
That was Connor from McIntyre Hall. With these issues and a part in the bill that only requests for a mile-wide parking area but does not require a parking garage, students were not looking forward to it.
I don't know. I think that's a good idea, I guess. I also think that we should maybe focus more on parking because, you know, parking is just awful here. Maybe turn it into a parking lot instead.
That was Riley Ross. Governor Mark Gordon signed the UW student housing bill into law. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Nolan Banky.
When we come back, a story about how Wyoming oil and gas regulations are not keeping up with new technology, and discussion about the carbon tax. This is Open Spaces. You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. A bipartisan group of lawmakers in Washington has proposed a bill that would impose a fee on carbon producers, passing that money along to the American people. But the idea of any sort of carbon tax is a prickly one. For our series, I Respectfully Disagree, Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spoke with Citizens Climate Lobby's Mary Keller, a supporter of the idea, and Robert Godby, an energy economist at the University of Wyoming, who has problems with it. Keller starts by explaining how this one is different from other carbon tax proposals.
So this is a neutral program in that it is not feeding a bureaucracy. It is simply a free market way to try to influence the economy toward the reduced use of fossil fuels. Now, the other piece I love about this is that when it gets distributed back to us so that we get to use it in what ways we feel is best for us, but that the bill cares about the elderly, the disadvantaged, the unemployed, that there are people who will receive more of the dividend benefit. And we've seen how the international markets are moving away from the coal. As that happens, all of us little people are not going to be paying through our teeth. Citizens Climate Lobby, the group who have been working on this, have proposed comprehensive legislation, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. It spells out then specifically how it is that this program will maintain a zero cost and it will be sunsetted over time as our transition towards new forms of energy, and Wyoming's going to be great at developing new forms of energy, as that transition happens, this legislation writes itself out of existence.
Yeah. Rob, I wonder if you can kind of respond and talk a little bit about, you know, is this approach, is it something that you see as potentially viable right now for making some changes on global warming?
Mary did a great job describing the general aspects of a tax like this. So, you know, this might be a respectfully disagree segment. I think generally Mary and I agree completely on the need to do something. And my concerns with this plan have more to do with, unfortunately, with any legislation, you do have to get down in the weeds and spell out the details. And that's where, you know, the rubber really meets the road. What I really worry about is whether trying to pursue legislation like that is really the best use of kind of scarce political capital that we have. There's only so much that we can get done before people either get fed up or they feel like they've done enough. And I worry that this kind of legislation, the way it's originally proposed, there will probably be compromises. And the concerns that I have are, you know, so what will those compromises be? In other places, we've seen carbon taxes get watered down to where they really don't make a significant difference. What sounds great in principle, when people hear the details of it, they're going to be a little bit concerned. This would start at a $15 per metric ton tax, and it would rise every year for 10 years at $10 a metric ton. So we're looking at the end of 10 years, a tax per metric ton at over $100. So what does that mean? Nobody really can picture a metric ton of carbon. What it means is that in the first year, if it were implemented, it would raise, say, gasoline prices by about 7%. It depends on what you assume the price of gas is. Right now, it's kind of modeled at about 16 cents a gallon. But it would rise very quickly over time. And you would get back, like Mary said, about $60 a month in the first year. That would go up by 10% each year. So the next year you'd get 72 per month for a family of four, so two adults, two kids, and that would go on. The concern I really have is just that is a really aggressive tax in economic terms, and that's the purpose of the tax. The reason it's modeled out to get the outcomes that it does is because it's going to create huge incentives to really change people's lifestyles. You won't just drive less. You will think about moving to new places.
And that seems like where there has been some issues, like in France when they tried to do a fuel tax. Wow, there was quite the outpouring of revolt. Mary, what do you say to that? How could that be something that might be overcome, or how would you address that?
Rod is absolutely right. This is an aggressive plan. They think that this can cut greenhouse gas emissions by 50% in 20 years. And that 20-year time frame says to me, we need to do this for the kids. So, yes, it's aggressive, but the kinds of outcomes that it potentially holds are the kinds that could preserve for our children some very basic human needs. When you understand some of the basics about the increased volatility of our weather right now, the droughts are longer, the heat is higher, the vortex cold comes down in horrendous blasts that go lower down the East Coast than they used to, and you think that this is what we're living with, it's got about a 40-year lag, just like your car has a lag in how soon it warms up. So it's going to be more volatile for our children. So I would say he's absolutely right. It's going to be tougher for us. And I want to say, Wyoming, are we ready? Can we do this? Are we going to be that generation that says, yeah, it will be tough? But you know what? We're not just going to resist because we want it to be cheap when we fill up our car.
You know, I just wonder just what sort of political momentum there is right now for this idea. I know that the bill that you mentioned does have some bipartisan support, but is that true across the country? Just wonder, Rob, if you can talk a little bit about the political mood right now.
Yeah, so the political mood is really against these sorts of things. When it gets framed in a particular way as a tax, for example, since the financial crisis, people have really lost their faith in markets and in economic policy. They tend to think that the rich do well and the poor people pay the bill. And that's a real problem. And that's really my biggest concern is not what this is for. I completely agree with Mary. This has to be done. It has to be done quickly. It has to be done soon. Climate change is the wickedest of problems, and it's because we as humans just aren't able to deal with it, right? The scale of the problem is unimaginable. And so our immediate reactions as humans is to not believe it. When we hear just how bad things could be, we disengage, we try to avoid it. And the real concern I have is if we get into a protracted debate about a carbon tax, we may miss the opportunity to do a lot of meaningful things right now.
Wyoming people have such an intimate relationship to a landscape that is bigger than us and that we know can kick our butts and that we have to plan and be careful. I look forward to every shoulder that has ever moved an ounce of coal has got its own experience and intelligence, and we will need all of this harnessed towards a transition. And I think we're going to experience a lot of that sense of satisfaction and a kind of love of freedom as we make things work and we don't look away and we don't hope that the storm's not coming. That includes innovation and being neighborly and looking at the wide open space and saying, we're good for this. We can do this.
That was the Citizen Climate Lobby's Mary Keller and UW Energy economist Robert Godbey speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards for our series, I Respectfully Disagree. Horizontal drilling is changing the game for the oil and gas industry. It's also creating a host of new problems. State regulations have not kept up with the new technology, and it has resulted in a race to operatorship. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports the legislature has a plan to tackle it.
It's starting to snow outside M&K Oil and Gas Company, a small producer headquartered in Gillette. Nathan McLeland is a third-generation manager there. Last summer, another producer put him in a bind. Let's call him Rick. Rick said he was going to start developing on McLeland's leases, either with or without him.
We're going to drill here, we're going to do it this way, and if you don't sign my joint operating agreement or you don't go along with what I'm going to do, I can force pull you.
That would basically mean McLeland forfeits his leases. Needless to say, he made a deal. While they both had rights to the minerals, Rick was the controlling operator, aka the decision maker. He had that status because he was the first to file a permit.
Currently, the way it works in Wyoming right now is whoever files the permit first becomes the operator. And so you can have someone with a small percentage of the ownership making all the decisions for this big area of land.
McLeland says this first-in-the-door method of operatorship has created a land grab. Everyone wants to be the first to file a permit.
They're permitting as fast as they can so that no one else gets in and becomes the operator of something they own. And it's not, I guess, a productive system and a cooperative system.
The Oil and Gas Conservation Commission says permit requests have grown to unprecedented numbers, seeing up to 30,000 applications on their desk. Meanwhile, all those permits aren't even resulting in new production. In some cases, it's even stopping producers from drilling.
So the complaints were slowly trickling in to the legislators over the summer and the fall.
That's Mike Greer, a Worland representative and co-chair of the Joint Minerals Committee. He says all these problems come down to a simple change in the industry, horizontal drilling.
Everything's geared towards vertical drilling. And with this horizontal drilling where they can place one pad and reach out 2 miles and drill, you know, what I've heard at times, 20 different wells from one pad location, it's really created an issue with landowners, minority mineral interest holders.
5 bills aimed to deal with updating regulations this past session. One sought to put financial pressure on developers to actually drill. Another would have dealt with McLeland's situation of operatorship. Several more tackled split estate issues with landowners. But none of them got very far. Greer explains that's because he has a plan for a comprehensive solution during the interim session.
I tried to do early on as a chairman of minerals is get my mind around the issues, sat down with some of the key players and just say, hey, rather than piecemeal legislation in that could cause us some problems down the road or have the unintended consequences that a lot of legislation does, this take a metered approach.
Greer says the first step will be to hear solutions from the governor's office, regulatory agencies, and the Petroleum Association of Wyoming, or PAW. Come August, he hopes to hear from landowners and any other stakeholders too. The PAW says it would like to see the updated system encourage partnership, lower the volume of permit applications, and encourage smooth development. Chairman of Wyoming's Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, Mark Watson, says he would like to see the system become more efficient, so they stop getting flooded with permit requests, especially if the operator doesn't intend to drill.
That's our main thing, is we want to see these wells drilled and the minerals developed.
He adds the ultimate goal is orderly development, but that's complicated.
It's not something that you can bang out really fast.
And landowners want this fixed too. Jo Morrison leads the Powder River Basin Resource Council. She says restructuring the rules needs to require stronger property rights protections. She explains mineral producers often abuse the outdated statutes.
Under the Split Estate Act, they can come in and if they say that you haven't negotiated in good faith with them, and that's part of one of the problems is what defines good faith negotiations, they come in and bond on, and you're left with no ability to have a say in what goes on your property.
Morrison says she's also worried about the rapid development of horizontal drilling when it comes to reclamation for horizontal wells. So she hopes to have a voice in the process of modernizing all these rules during the interim session.
We haven't had any invitations, but I think we'll have to insert ourselves into the process.
Morrison says she'd like to see the companies be required to drill within 6 months of getting a permit application so they stop locking up land. Nathan McLeland at M&K Oil and Gas says he's optimistic the legislature's plan will help bring solutions to light.
I think now people are realizing that this is not a good system. It doesn't create efficiency. It doesn't lead to wells getting developed or drilled. You know, I think we can come up with something better.
Representative Mike Rear says the first interim meeting to start discussing the issues will happen in May in Gillette. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
As we mentioned earlier, it's Sunshine Week, the annual event that recognizes the importance of access to public information and the journalists who defend a culture of transparency. So I sat down with reporter Tennessee Watson to talk about her struggle to get information out of elected officials in Albany County. So Tennessee, maybe for the listeners who haven't been following this story as closely as others, maybe just the basics of what happened here?
Sure. In early November 2018, there was an officer-involved shooting in Laramie, and I've been trying to follow this story, and I haven't been able to find out a lot of information.
Recently, we did learn there was an autopsy that was released, and then you've been trying to follow up on that, and again, you're being stonewalled?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And that autopsy that was released, it was actually obtained by the family of Robbie Ramirez, who died, and then it was released by a community group. But that sort of brought attention to the fact that elected officials are not being super public. You know, when I've reached out to Dave O'Malley, the sheriff, reached out to county commissioners, reached out to our county attorney, Peggy Trent, they've all told me that they can't comment and that they've been directed not to comment by something called the Local Government Liability Pool. And that's the entity that provides liability insurance for our county.
So my experience with everyone, and I know Sheriff O'Malley the longest probably because he was the police chief and a detective for many years. My experience with him is he will tell you lots of things. In this instance, what he's told you on background is he essentially can't talk to you about any of this. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. And what I've come to discover is that the Local Government Liability Pool is the insurance that provides legal counsel to the county. And if that legal counsel, say there's a suit and they were to lose, they would also cover the cost of those judgments. And so they're being advised not to talk because if they talk and Albany County were to lose a case, it would be very expensive for the pool. And just to give a little bit more background on that, this pool started, it was set up by our state legislature in the 1980s as a way to provide lower cost liability insurance. So it's a pretty amazing resource for our small towns and counties that don't have a lot of money.
We did get a lot of information from Peggy Trent early on. She had a press conference. Did they object to that?
I don't know if they objected to that, but it definitely seems like after Peggy Trent was very public, then they got word not to talk anymore. And I think, you know, the basic idea is that they don't want elected officials to say anything that would prejudice the defense. And I think that that's a really tricky situation because on one hand, as a journalist, I feel like elected officials have an obligation to say what's going on. But I also consider the fact that as elected officials, they're stewards of our county's finances. And the reason that this could end up being really expensive is that the contract that the county signed with the Local Government Liability Pool, it very clearly says in the rules and regulations, if they fail to cooperate with the defense, that the liability pool could drop our county.
Now, you are talking to some of these officials behind the scenes, off the record. It's an agreed off the record just to understand what the heck is going on here. Are they frustrated by this?
they know that as elected officials that their constituents expect that they're going to provide information. But that's where they're presented with this really difficult choice, which is, do they put themselves at risk of costing taxpayers money, or do they sort of honor this desire on the part of constituents and let them know what's going on? Those are two competing responsibilities.
So I guess the thought would be that if we want transparency and we want to hear what they think, we need to wait till it goes to the courthouse.
Within this current framework, yeah, that is the option. I guess the other alternative is that Albany County could bow out of this insurance. They could pay out of pocket if they face any litigation and get to say whatever they want.
That would mean that if the Ramirez family was to win a lawsuit against the county, that would be very expensive for Albany County.
I think that's part of what our elected officials are trying to avoid.
The thing about Albany County, and a lot of our listeners may not understand this, I believe the last revenue picture I saw, it's the second poorest county in the state of Wyoming. I know when we've had some other high-profile cases here, that's always been a consideration, and there's been concern that this could actually bankrupt Albany County.
I know for me, going into this, part of my expectation that public officials, elected officials would talk is that I see elected officials in larger cities.
Chicago is an example, which has a few officer-related shootings. They regularly have press conferences and talk about these things.
So here's why they can talk. They have a big enough tax base and they have enough money that they can absorb judgments. And they also oftentimes self-insure and they hire their own attorneys. And so the calculus of going public, that's one that they make internally, and they decide whether they're willing to absorb the potential costs of litigation. And in smaller communities without that tax base, they really rely on liability pools to cover them. And so that's how they end up in these situations where they've signed contracts that says you will cooperate with the defense, and if you don't, you could lose your coverage.
Flip side of this, though, is this seems like this could be an out for elected officials often whenever things get a little sticky.
Yeah, and that is one of my big questions is, you know, is there an alternative to what we have right now? Obviously, we don't want to cost taxpayers extra money, but at the same time, it would be great if public officials could even just tell us what's going on, even if they're not willing to speak to the specifics of the officer-involved shooting, just to be able to say, here's how we want to address policies and procedures for law enforcement. And even though they might be thinking about those things, they can't tell us.
And as I said, this could also be misused and you have people hiding behind a curtain.
Yeah. And I think as long as we remember that, that's sort of the best that we can do right now.
Tennessee Watson is our education reporter. She also covers a number of other issues, clearly, here at Wyoming Public Radio for us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
When we come back, a look at the history of the Winchester repeating arms rifle. And we take you out to clear snow with the city of Gillette. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. And now, a trip down memory lane. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska looks at the history of the Winchester Repeating Arms Company and the surprising marketing strategy that helped cement its rifle's place in the myth of the West.
If you are a Wild West film fan, then you've probably seen Winchester 73.
I didn't get a chance to use that gun, Matthew!
True Grit.
Fill your hand, you son of a...
In High Noon.
On this our wedding day, do not forsake me, oh my darling.
Wait. Besides being films about the West, all of these films also feature a Winchester Model 1873 rifle. The carbine has widely been credited as being the gun that won the West. Danny Michael is the assistant curator at the Cody Firearms Museum. He says the history might be a little iffy whether the rifle really won the West, but
they were really successful at selling that idea that their guns were the ones that were influential to the West. And they used that throughout the 20th century, and especially heavy in kind of the mid to late 20th century, with lots of movie marketing, lots of PR stunts.
Those stunts included driving a stagecoach through New York City with one of the Winchester executives holding a Winchester rifle and making movies with their guns as a centerpiece. But there was one particular stunt that seemed a little unusual to digital archivist Mac Frost.
I kept trying to figure out what in the world was going on with this and why these pictures were in there.
Frost is the archivist at the McCracken Research Library. He was going through and digitizing a collection of Winchester archives when...
And all of a sudden I came across all these publicity stills of this hanging.
After some digging, Frost figured out the hanging photos were part of the Winchester marketing department trying to make up for a mistake in a photo that they used in a 1962 catalog.
It's talking about 19 out of 20 Texas Rangers use Winchester. The only problem is that the picture that was used is not of Texas Rangers. It's of Arizona Rangers, and a very historical photo, as a matter of fact. The advertising department just didn't do their research well enough.
And in order to make up for it, they decided to hang the advertising executive who came up with the ad campaign and, of course, document the mock hanging.
They have a whole bunch of members of the Phoenix JCs who are dressed up as the posse, and they're all carrying Winchester rifles, of course. And they take him out to an area where he's given the opportunity to have one last cigarette while he's being measured for his coffin.
There are 9 images altogether, and in the end, the ad executive is forgiven. Frost says it was all a publicity gag for the company, and it probably had to do with their intended audience.
Here you've got a state in the West which is proud of their gun ownership, and the last thing they want to do is irk the folks who buy their guns into buying some other brand of gun.
The company associated itself so much with the West that it had to make sure it respected the different type of ranger. Danny Michael says today, Winchester can't really pull off the same kind of stunts.
I doubt you'd see a stagecoach with a bunch of execs holding Winchesters in New York City today as a successful marketing campaign.
But back then, the strategy was a success.
A lot of their guns ended up in the sort of spaghetti Westerns of the Western TV shows and that kind of thing. So people saw a movie, they saw Winchester 73, and then they wanted to go get a Winchester rifle, and they did.
And through those movies, the legend of the Winchester 73 lives on. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
I only know I must be brave, or I must face a man who hates me.
This week's snowstorm brought several inches of snow and snowdrifts between 3 and 6 feet high. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler found out that getting rid of that snow is harder than you think.
On Thursday morning after the storm, Gillette residents started to dig themselves out. And for some, that took all day. In the downtown, parking was impossible, so the city's road crews waited until dark to address the problem. Jeremy Hagen is the street crews leader.
This is our Gillette Avenue cleanup, and this is something we do after each big snowstorm.
Gillette Ave is one of the main streets of downtown, and they're cleaning up about 5 blocks of it. Giant machines are scooping up the snow into dump trucks.
We're starting off with cleaning off the sidewalks, pushing them into the street, and then we load everything up and haul it off to our snow dumps.
And clearing it can take all night. Scott Oslin is one of the members of the streets crew. He says they have a number of big piles about the size of a car, and loading those piles takes some time.
That's a big pile. Yeah. That's going to take 10 or 15 or 20 dump truck loads. And that's, a half a street.
Those dump trucks take the snow to one of the 5 main dump sites around town, where the smallest is about the size of a football field. Hagen predicts how long it will take for those piles to melt.
Yeah, I'd say middle of July, probably.
The night crew was out on the streets during the storm. Hagen says it was an eventful work night.
It was pretty bad. A lot of times we were losing entire lanes on roads, with 2-3 foot drifts coming across, and just having a hard time getting our priority routes taken care of.
Oslin says the wind was a huge factor and it made clearing the snow a tremendous challenge.
It is so stressful. You know, you're dealing with the roads and the cars and then, of course, just the snow. You want to do a good job. And this is the first winter I've ever plowed snow. And I'm shocked how stressful it can be.
Oslin says the wind was a huge factor and it made clearing the snow a tremendous challenge.
We just take pride in it. We want to make the streets look as good as we possibly can. I mean, just like tonight, you know, 24 hours ago was a pretty bad blizzard, and you wouldn't really know it other than the piles of snow that we're picking up.
This winter, Gillette has had almost 3 weeks of below freezing temperatures and an abundance of road closures thanks to heavy snow and strong winds. But it's March, so Hagen and Oslin are hopeful this will be the last big night shift moving snow.
We'll see. Yeah, I think it is. I think it's going to be. But that's part of the job. You just never know. I mean, it could snow tonight and you're going out.
But Hagen adds,
I'm really over it. I'm ready for spring. I'm ready for next week in the 40s and 50s.
And one can only hope the forecast comes true. For Wyoming Public Radio in Gillette, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed a segment or want to hear this or other Open Spaces programs, just go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. You can also sign up for our podcast on that site or wherever you get your podcasts. Our web editor, Anna Rader, makes all of this possible.
Your support of Wyoming Public Radio makes our local news happen. It allows our reporters to cover the stories that matter. Just go to our website and click on the Pledge Now button.
Our next show will be in 2 weeks. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.